Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us today. The Dozier School for Boys dates back to the early 1900s, and its history is a dark one. A warning to our listeners in the car, and if you have children around, this story involves very sensitive material. Now, the school was a reformatory program for young boys based in the Panhandle. It was in the city of Marianna. Over the course of its 111 years of operation, there were hundreds of documented cases of physical assault, torture, and death. And it was finally shut down in 2011. An anthropological team from the University of South Florida surveyed the site in 2012 and found nearly 100 unmarked graves. Back in April of this year, a subcontractor surveying the site after Hurricane Michael found 27 anomalies in the ground using ground-penetrating radar. The USF team, led by Aaron Kimmerly, returned to see if there were more unmarked graves, but none were found. Journalist Ben Montgomery followed the Dozier story for years when he worked at the Tampa Bay Times. He spoke with many of the young men who survived the school. Now he runs Gangry.com, an online long-form journalism platform, and he joins us now from the studios of WUSF in Tampa. Ben, thank you so much for your time today.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
How did you find the story of the Dozier School? How did that come to you?
I was reading my own newspaper, interestingly, like many folks who first discovered it. So five men who had been there in the 1950s and 1960s had sort of found each other online. And this is all the way back in 2007, 2008. And they convinced the state to let them have a little ceremony that they referred to as the closing of the White House. The White House was a notorious building on campus where the boys were punished. They were beaten with a weighted leather strap by guards. And it came to represent for these five men sort of a place of nightmares and a place that was difficult to shake. So they had found each other online, just kind of almost randomly going in search of others who had a shared experience. And they convinced the state to let them have a little press conference, which was covered by the Associated Press. And Brendan Farrington in Tallahassee wrote a story that that shocked me. When I read it in the Metro section of the St. Petersburg Times in 2008, I was blown away that I had not heard of the Dozier School for Boys. And some of the things the men were quoted as saying in that story really took my breath away. They talked about seeing blood on the walls, being forced face first onto a cot and being beaten until their underwear disintegrated and their backside split open. And I walked over to my editor and I said, we need to do something about this. And she agreed. And that was 11 years ago. So we're still writing about the place.
Remind us briefly of, and I touched on it just a little bit in the intro, what the Dozier School for Boys was, because, again, it's been around for a very long time.
Sure. It was established and opened in 1900. And interestingly, it followed the 1898 death of a 16-year-old boy who had been accused of a crime and had been leased out to a boss, and the kid was beaten to death. And the people of Florida were so outraged by this death, which was covered by the newspapers, that they demanded the state create its own institution for dealing with juvenile convicts. And so Dozier was born in 1900 in Jackson County, Florida. It was back then called the Florida Industrial School for Boys and Girls. And it was, for all intents and purposes, meant to be a sort of training school. If you were a kid who was incorrigible or truant, or maybe had been convicted of some kind of more serious crime, you were sent to Dozier. And Dozier was going to straighten you out, and you worked half time on the farm, and then went to school for the rest of the time. But from the beginning, it was a place that was scandalized, that was horrible for children. Starting all the way back in 1903, when investigators for the state government in Tallahassee showed up in Marianna and found kids as young as six locked in irons like common criminals.
Back to that, even back then, I mean, was there a system in place for juvenile justice in the country?
No, there really wasn't. In fact, you weren't provided legal representation when you know, if you were a juvenile and you stood to face charges. Often that decision, whether you had, you know, committed the crime or not, that decision fell to a sheriff. Often, or in the event you got to show up in court, a judge could consider the facts of the case as presented by the police and send you off to Dozier without, without any recourse, without any legal representation.
Interesting. You mentioned even cases going back to the turn of the last century. And did anybody at that point make the effort to say, wait a minute, this shouldn't be happening. Maybe we should investigate.
Oh, sure. Many people, including, including a handful over the years, over 111 years, a handful of courageous investigative journalists. Many people would show up there, discover kids being neglected or abused or mistreated, report on it. The headlines would outrage Floridians, who would demand that there be some level of reform. And the school itself would promise reform. They would often fire the superintendent, for instance, or change the name of the school. And it was known by many different names: the Florida Industrial School for Boys, the Florida School for Boys, the Arthur G. Dozier School for Boys, Jackson County Youthful Offender Center. It was like every scandal, they would promise reform, change the name of the institution, and Floridians would sort of, go back to their normal lives and forget about this place. And the people in charge there would go right back to abusing and neglecting children in their care.
I guess it's, thinking about, what you said before, there was no system in place for juvenile justice. So if there wasn't a system, there wasn't a foundation on how this should be done. So nobody questioned it, I guess.
Right. That's very much the case. And you see the school itself sort of take the shape of the era. So from the beginning, it was meant to reform and rehabilitate kids. And then a bunch of people had different ideas about that. But by the 19-teens, it had become a profitable farm. They raised cows, dairy cows, beef cows. They raised pigs, chickens. They raised some crops. They, at some point, had a brick-making facility. At one point, the school did all of the printing of government documents from Tallahassee. And these were the trades that boys got to learn when they were sent there. But it had become so profitable that you start to see in the 1920s, the school needed more kids. This had become a system of free labor, and they wrote to the government in Tallahassee, too few boys make the crops come in slow. And right around that time, the late 1920s, you see the codes for juvenile law begin to change to make criminal things such as truancy and incorrigibility, whatever that means. And so the numbers at the school skyrocketed from several hundred boys to, at one point, more than 800 boys. And it was, for a moment, the largest reform school in the country.
You know, when you have a story like this that covers over a century, and you have all these victims and all of these really what seems so unbelievable stories, what was your approach in trying to unravel, all of this, to
sure.
make sense of it?
From the beginning, the question was, is this true? Are the stories these men, these grown men are telling right now, are they true? And it took a handful of interviews for me to understand that this is the absolute truth, that this trauma had so affected these men that there was no way, there's no way they could have triggered the waterworks, the crying, as they told me about it, often for the first time. While I was doing my interviews, my approach was, I'm going to talk to as many people as I possibly can. And it turns out that was very easy. From the beginning, I called one of the original five, known as the White House Boys. Robert Straley lived in Clearwater. Robert died about 6 months ago. But I called him up. I said, anybody who contacts you after that AP story had run that I read, anybody who contacts you, please just pass along my phone number, because I'd like to talk to everybody I possibly can. And men started coming out of the woodwork. What started as five men who had found each other online very quickly, in a matter of about a year, had grown to more than 400 men. And so we were in hot pursuit of the truth. And once it became, once we started looking at the historical record and realized that, people had been reporting on this place and blowing the whistle on this place for 100 years, it became very clear to us that this was in fact true. And And we wondered what the institution was like in modern times. This place had been given so many chances to change its ways and reform itself. Were boys being treated poorly, you know, in 2009, 2010?
You have these men who, and now they're, I mean, we're talking about men now, much later in their life, you know, going back and sharing stories of their experience. And in many cases, probably the first time they're open about the stories. Was it hard to get them to want to share, to want to go back and relive that, you know, the trauma?
Quite the opposite. And I was just met with one of them earlier this morning, Charlie Fudge. And we were talking about this very thing. You know, many of them upon leaving the school, and they served terms anywhere from 8 months to several years. When they were leaving the school, the guards told them, "We know where you live. And if you tell anybody what happened, we know how to find you." And so many of them buried this secret that was often associated with shame and things like that. They buried it. They didn't tell their parents. When they grew up and got married, they didn't tell their wives, didn't tell their children. And so often talking to me was the first time that they had shared their experience. And it took asking one question, "Tell me about the school." And you know, I've talked to more than 400 men who've been there, and by and large, they would start and you know, wouldn't stop talking for several hours.
This school is based in the tiny town, as I mentioned, of Mariana in the Florida Panhandle. Just briefly remind people, I mean, this is, you know, it's not far from the capital, but there's not a lot up there.
Yeah, it's about 60 miles west. You'll know it because of a couple of interstate exits. And there's a little Walmart and a cluster of hotels around the Marion exit off I-10. Small town. It's known as the City of Southern Charm. That's sort of the motto. You know, but for a very long time, it was sort of isolated from modern society. There were a couple of notorious lynchings in the 1920s and 1930s in Mariana, including the lynching of Claude Neal, where 5,000 people participated in the murder of a man who had stood accused of a crime. So you know, on top of that sort of dark history, the Dozier School, of course, was there from 1900 to 2011. You know, it's a place that has tried, since I've been reporting on this, to protect its reputation as a nice, hospitable, southern small town. And the folks there, many of them have responded, responded negatively to this kind of attention, to the attention that the Tampa Bay Times and other newspapers and television stations and radio stations have brought to it. And so there was a moment a few years ago when a handful of the Chamber of Commerce's Citizens of the Year actually spoke out against the press and said, "You're painting us in an unfair way." And they have opposed the anthropology team from USF, who's been trying to unearth the graves and return boys' bodies to their families. They've opposed that at every turn, legally and otherwise. So they're not super receptive to us shining a light in their town.
I'm talking with journalist Ben Montgomery. He's a former investigative reporter with the Tampa Bay Times, and he's written numerous stories that give the inside perspective into the Dozier School for Boys. This is the reformatory school in northern Florida, where numerous kids were brutally harassed, tortured, beaten, and there have been unmarked graves discovered there. You can read the investigation on our social media, WLRN Sundial. You know, again, you spoke with a number of these men who attended the school in the 1960s, one of them, Jerry Cooper. Briefly, again, just tell us a little bit about him. You know, how did you find him? But again, this comes back to what you said earlier, is that it was hard to believe until you started to, you know, get more and more stories. Then all of a sudden it's like, wait a second, okay, there's truth in this.
Yeah, and we looked at the historic record. I mean, again, the newspapers in Florida have been writing about this place periodically for its entire lifespan. I can't remember exactly how I met Jerry, but Jerry was miffed that there were people who were calling him a liar. And Jerry's the kind of guy who can get things done. He has a temper, he'll tell you that. It made him angry to no end that there were certain people, Jackson County locals and otherwise, who said that he and his brothers, the White House boys, were making all of this up. And so Jerry submitted himself, paid for it himself, submitted himself to a lie detector test to try to prove that he had, in fact, been beaten in the White House. And Jerry's got an interesting story in that, you know, he says that he took 135 lashes when he was taken to the White House, which is the you know, only person I know of who says he received that many licks. It's an incredible number of swats to take. Swats, that's putting it too lightly. That's a heck of a beating.
NPR reporter Greg Allen talked with Cooper back in 2012, and he gave some insight into that experience. Here's a little bit of that.
We weren't bad kids. We might have needed help in some respect, but that wasn't the place to find it, I'll tell you that right now. These were not spankings. These were beatings, brutal beatings.
Did you get the impression, you know, in talking with these men, that they may be suffering right now from, you know, some form of PTSD?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. From the very first day I started doing interviews, it became clear to me that this trauma that they experienced as children had manifested itself in a variety of ways. And, you know, some of them have physical scars on their backsides. Others have had problems with their lower backs and their hips. So that physical trauma, you can see. The emotional trauma manifests itself in a number of different ways. I've talked to guys who can't sleep with the lights off. These are men in their 70s, and their entire lives they've slept with the lights on because they're still scared of the dark. Probably most profoundly, I was interviewing a man in Miami. This is going back 10 years. His name's Stu Kruger, and Stu told me about his experience of being taken to the White House and beaten. And he said, what I remember about it is we had some privileges, and so we were allowed to go into the town to watch a movie on a Saturday. And on the way back, he and his buddy decided, they watched The Bridge Over the River Kwai. On the way back, he and his buddy decided they were going to run for it, and they slipped off into the woods and got caught a short time later. And they were taken to the White House, and his friend went in for the beating first. And so Stu sat outside listening to his friend scream out for his mother. And it was all he could do to, you know, to stay still. And so he leaned over and he picked up a small pebble, a tiny pebble, and he said that he focused all of his attention on that pebble, and it was almost like it had a calming effect on him. So his buddy's getting beaten, and he just puts his whole self into concentrating on this little pebble as he holds it between his fingers. He reached into his pocket during that interview, and he pulled out that pebble, and he said, I've been carrying this for 50 years. And every time I get nervous, I pull it out of my pocket, and I rub it in between my fingers. And that is, that's profound. You know, that is the physical manifestation of childhood trauma.
You know, the school gets shut down in 2011. You're talking 111 years later. What finally shut it down?
Well, the state said it was for budgetary reasons, that there was no longer a need for that many beds in a juvenile detention center. I am confident that there may be some truth to that, but there's also truth to the fact that a maverick reformer who comes from South Florida took over as the secretary of the Department of Juvenile Justice and decided, after reading the reporting from the Times and from other papers, decided that this facility had run its course and that no level of reform, you know, could change this dark past. And so she shuttered it. She closed the doors. I stood outside the very last day it was open with a guy named Bryant Middleton. And interestingly, Bryant comes from Fort Walton Beach. And he drove up because he wanted to be present at the school and make sure that they shut it, put the lock around the gate, turned off the lights. And so he stood there for several hours one afternoon waiting for the last employee to come out. Bryant had gotten two Purple Hearts in Vietnam. He was an Army Ranger in Vietnam. And he told me, I'd go back to Nam in a heartbeat before I'd go back to the Dozier School for Boys at Marianna.
That's very telling. Yeah. You know, I mentioned earlier Aaron Kimmerly, USF forensic anthropologist, and they were there not too long ago because after Hurricane Michael, they had found that perhaps there were maybe more graves, but they didn't find anything. But have you heard anything else about her team and what they're searching for and how long that search will continue?
Yeah, so they now will begin using LIDAR, and I don't know a lot about the science of this, but as I understand it, you can take a radar image of what's beneath the Earth's surface from a plane or a drone or a helicopter. And so so it's essentially ground-penetrating radar, but shot from above. And so they're going to continue searching for additional bodies for additional cemeteries using this LIDAR. It's a big campus, 1,400 acres. She's excavated a good portion of that, somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 acres out of 1,400. And they've run cadaver dogs over much of the property, but it's still a lot of land to search for graves. And this last firm that was doing the ground penetrating radar work and discovered these anomalies, I think they paused their work and they turned it over to the state out of an abundance of caution. They saw something unusual under the ground and decided, you know, somebody who knows what they're doing should get in here and do some excavation. And so Aaron and her team went back up, did that excavation on these anomalies, which were possibly graves. And it turns out they were just burnt roots, tree roots, a couple of them, you know, some refuse here and there, old pipes that had been buried below ground and things like that. So there were no discoveries this time. And as it stands, Aaron Kimmerly and her team have unearthed 51 sets of remains out of 55 graves, which is 20 more or so than the state originally said were buried there.
Is there any discussion about reparations, about giving any of these former, I guess, I don't know, you call them the kids' patients, but kids who were at this house, any of these men, anything for what they went through? Are there lawsuits in place right now?
Yeah, the group of White House boys, which said now amounts to, they seem to be dying every day, honestly. I've lost a lot of good friends, you know, just from age and things like that. So their struggle continues, though. They filed a civil lawsuit, class action suit, going all the way back to 2010. That has morphed and taken different shapes and now is in the form of a claims bill, which gets presented to the state legislature year after year. But they've not yet received any sort of action from the state in that regard. The state did last year issue a formal public apology. They passed a bill that formally apologized to the men for what they experienced there. But as Charlie Fudge told me earlier this morning, you know, they'd like compensation. They feel like this ruined their lives in many ways. And they feel like they're owed something for that.
You think about all the years you've spent reporting on this story. Are there any unanswered questions for you? You still want to find?
Sure. I've talked to men who remember seeing other graveyards, and you know, and these were men who were there at all different times. One guy in the 1980s was part of a land crew who's clearing some land, and you know, he tells me now he's at Rayford right now. He's a longtime criminal. But he tells me that, you know, they unearthed human remains while they were plowing a field, and work stopped. And, you know, the boss comes or the guard comes over and says, everybody get in the van. Nobody saw anything. And so they were, they had to promise that they wouldn't tell anybody about it. But there are stories like that all over the place, you know, from men who were there in the 40s, 50s and 60s, but also guys who were there more recently who remember seeing another cemetery. So my question is, are there more bodies on that property? And I think that's what Aaron Kimmerly and her team from the University of South Florida are in hot pursuit of right now.
Ben Montgomery, former investigative reporter with the Tampa Bay Times. His story, For Their Own Good, provides that inside perspective into the Dozier School for Boys. You can read the investigation on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Ben, thank you so much for sharing.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, still to come, the Ultra Music Festival is coming back to Bayfront. What changed in the course of a year? We'll try to figure that out coming up next on Sundial.